Okay, just to be helpful to everyone that's here, are there folk who are here for the first time just on some of these? Yeah, okay. No, that's fine, because what I try to do is rather than just sort of drop this into a vacuum, just to give you a little bit of context. It's not long, it's kind of 2 or 3 minutes. The conflict, I guess, that I grew up in really was kind of 69 through to 1998. So really, I was very much a child, a teenager, a young adult, and a mature adult living through that conflict. That was the most recent because, depending where you want to start in history, some people say the Irish conflict goes way, way back to 12th century. But really, the epicenter was probably 16th and 17th century with all that religious chaos that was taking place in Europe. I mean, come ahead, folk. Don't worry about walking past me. There's some seats, I think, over here. So come ahead, walk past me. There's absolutely no problem with that at all. How are you? You're in our row as well. You're fine. And as I was saying the other day, in a very, very small population, because Northern Ireland is a tiny, tiny little place, much less of a population than some major American cities, around about 1.7 million. But just to kind of recap, in that 30-year block, there were 47,000 injuries, 36,000 shootings, 22,000 armed robberies, over 30,000 people went through the penal system, 16,000 bombings, over 2,000 arson attacks, and almost 4,000 dead. And I try to lift those figures into an American context. So this had to happen in the United States over a 30-year period, pro rata. You're talking 800,000 dead and 6.4 million political prisoners. So the legacy issue back home for us today is absolutely major. If you were to say to me, Gary, almost 20 years after the signing of the Good Friday Agreement, we're struggling with the concept of dealing with the past. So that is our major issue. The talk I want to kind of move through today, the bulk of it was published 3 or 4 months ago in the Palestine-Israeli Journal. And there's lots of other articles in that. The Department of Foreign Affairs of the Irish government asked about 10 or 15 of us to do a book in the Palestine-Israeli Journal on lessons from the Irish peace process, which may be applicable to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And I think it's fair enough to say this from my perspective, that the Good Friday Agreement is not the panacea for the Middle East. I think it's important to say that. Some politicians who were involved in it would almost lift it as a kind of blueprint. I think it's more important to say there are lessons that are applicable to other situations. I've never done any work in Colombia, although a number of colleagues have, and I know Santos, the current president there, was in Belfast about 2 months ago, and he said the Good Friday Agreement for him as a human being was a major influence. Because, as you know, ultimately the government there did move into conversations and negotiations with FARC. So they learned some of the lessons from that. A lot of my work is hosting Israelis and Palestinians in Belfast. I'm not really saying this is the blueprint. I often describe it to Israelis and Palestinians like this. Just pretend you're sitting in the stands watching a football game and take some of the lessons as you see the Irish play spill out on the field that may be applicable for you. So today when I do this lecture, I am not being bombastic and arrogant and giving you, 10 steps to dealing with extremism in the United States. I don't think things like that work. I'm always cautious in bookstores when I go in and I see 7 steps to spiritual success or 7 steps to great sex. You go, really? Because those kind of models don't exist. So let me just try to move through this. And again, as I said before, this doesn't have to be all monotone. We're here for about sort of 90 minutes or less. So if you want to break in the middle of something I'm saying, or you need clarification, just break in and say, Gary, help me understand that better, and we'll be able to do that. So just a bit of kind of to begin with, a little bit of personal context. So background-wise, I'm a Methodist clergy person. I'm on the Protestant side of the fence in a religious framework. Identity-wise, I have multiple identities, shaped very much by the British concept, but also the Irish concept, and also the European concept. I was chatting to a person who's here this morning, and we were just chatting about a little bit more detail of what shaped me as a human being, for better or for worse. My grandfather fought against the Turks at the Dardanelles in a very bloody, barbaric campaign. He was very severely injured by shrapnel, almost died, and returned back home with a wound in his head round about here that literally a small baby could have put their fist into. And my sort of early memories as a little boy going to church, he sort of regimentally marched us all to church on a Sunday morning. But like most men, he was a little bit vain. And every Sunday morning as a tiny little boy sitting in the pew, he had this big mop of white hair. And he always used to put his head down to me and say, "Gary, is my wound covered?" As a tiny sort of six-year-old, at times I used to fix his hair to cover this gaping hole that was in his head. My Uncle Jimmy, who taught me how to swim as a little boy, was rescued at Dunkirk as the Nazis literally pushed the British into the sea, and he came back in again during D-Day, on the second day of D-Day, with an Irish tank regiment, as one of the first in also to liberate Belsen. During the conflict, a lot of my family served in the police. Some of them still carry the scars of that. Some of them also served in British regiments. So that British narrative shaped me as a human being. But I live in the island of Ireland, so I was shaped very much by my Irishness. The irony about our campaign is the more the campaign went on, the more those on my side of the fence felt more British. In the kind of 40s and 50s, many of them would describe themselves as Irish unionists. But the more the conflict progressed, that identity, that firm British identity, became much more cemented. And then obviously the whole European thing and the chaos of Brexit. Joyce and I did vote to remain. We were one of the 56%, and we can talk a little bit about that later on. So, and that concept, as I said yesterday, I carry a British passport and an Irish passport. I spent 30 years in Belfast, never more than 100 metres from those peace lines that I told you were basically massive Berlin-type walls that separate Catholics and Protestant communities. If you'd ask me, is this echoing? Slightly. Well, what I can do is just pull it down a little, okay? Is that better, yeah?
Yes.
Okay. If you would ask me to describe my life, I would say I've tried to be an influencer in people who are pursuing political violence. So I have negotiated with those within the IRA on the Republican side and those on the Unionist Loyalist side who see themselves as pro-British, trying to move them away from militant terrorism or militant political violence into political inclusion. From 92 to 99, myself and a Catholic Dominican sister spearheaded a project called Fourspring, literally right on one of those interfaces, trying to bring people into dialogue, trying to bring about a safe space. We called them uncomfortable or difficult conversations. And then from 1999 until about 2 to 3 years ago, I played a key role in an urban project called Skenos. Skenos is the Greek word for tent. And I guess theologically, we played about with the John 1 and verse 14 text, where literally you can transliterate by saying, "And Jesus moved into our neighborhood and pitched his tent among us." So we tried to create a space in the inner city. So we had about 100 staff working at East Belfast Mission on homelessness, employability, peace building, and a multiplicity of other ministries. 2 years ago, I started this small NGO called Rethinking Conflict, spent my time now between the Middle East, still very much in that Irish context, and also the United States. A good friend of mine, Francis Teeney, who's a research fellow at Queen's University, said this: "We most certainly knew how to end the war. We just don't know how to build the peace." We most certainly knew how to end the war. We just don't know how to build the peace. And in that context, that's been very much where we are in that Irish mechanism at the moment. I mean, George Mitchell, your own Democratic senator, the facilitator, and he said very clearly that the implementation of the Good Friday Agreement would be much more difficult than getting to the agreement. So the actual implementation of the agreement would be much more difficult than getting to the agreement. Let me talk for a few moments about what I'm calling context. And as I mentioned yesterday, there was a context for many people that took up arms. If you remember the statistic we talked about yesterday, that 80% of people who went through our penal system, if they hadn't been born in another part of the globe, never would have pursued political violence. So the question arises, why did 80% of a population that went through the penal system make those choices? So let me look at this whole concept of what I'm calling context and terrorism before we moved on to the armed struggle to political struggle. So if people living in a very deeply divided society feel there are no alternatives to change in a political framework, there is always the possibility they may resort to violence. Okay? Now, on a personal note, I'm more than happy to say I want to choose a peaceful, non-violent strategy. But let's just say for now, there is always the potential, there is always the possibility that others may make different choices. So in our community, on the loyalist or unionist or pro-British side, a considerable number did. On the Republican, Irish, Catholic side, a considerable number did. Particularly those of my generation growing up in the 60s and the 70s and in the 80s. It has been said very clearly that the only way to bring violence to an end is to talk to the people who hold the guns. And for many people, that is an incredibly difficult choice to make. But the constant stalemate in our conflict drove certain people who realise we really need new thinking to look for some unconventional ways to end this bloody conflict. A number of those conversations began within the prisons in the late 1980s or 1990s. A number of us were having conversations with people who believed the only way forward to achieve their political goals was through armed struggle. And it was here the church played a key role. So I want to say to folk in the United States that politicians at that stage were not officially talking to people pursuing political violence. But people of faith could take that risk strategically that politicians couldn't. So I'm just asking in your context, as you talk to people who you may say are on your extremes, I would want to be suggesting that people of faith should be leading the way in relation to that very difficult, protracted dialogue. Armed struggle to political struggle. In the 1980s, within the Republican movement, within the IRA, there began to emerge what they call a twin-track approach to achieving their political goals. So through the 70s and through most of the 80s, there was what they primarily called the Armalite or the AK-47. But they gradually evolved in, they use this phraseology, not that it's clean, but the ballot box in one hand and the Armalite in the other. I mean, at the moment in the Middle East, I mean, Hamas are another typical example of that. Because when Hamas was formed, as all of us in this room knew, it was primarily through what they would call armed struggle or liberation. Hamas now have also developed a political wing, as you know. And I suppose the hope and prayer is that gradually they will ditch the AK-47 and move into some form of political engagement. So the Republican, the IRA, their motive was ballot box in one hand and the Armalite in the other. By the time 1994 came, the Armalite was painfully moving out of their mechanism. But let me kind of tease out how that happened. So they were on what I called an evolutionary path, from what they called armed struggle towards political struggle. There was agreement between both the British and the Irish and the American administrations that there needed to be a new way of thinking to get beyond the constant downward spiral of futile violence. We needed confidence-building measures that were crucial. So there is another phrase I want you just to take out. What in the United States does a confidence-building measure look like? Okay, so I'm just throwing out these phrases, I'm asking you to do the hard work or the heavy lifting in relation to what does a confidence-building measure look like. So some of those confidence-building measures came from the British government. So Peter Brook, who was a British Secretary of State, in the early 1990s made a speech. And he used this phraseology saying, Britain has no selfish, strategic or economic interests in Northern Ireland and would accept unification of the island if the people wished it. Then he said, it is not the aspiration to a sovereign united Ireland against which we set our face, but its violent expression. Now, the speech had a huge impact, as you can imagine, on Republican IRA nationalist thinking. It paved the way for the Downing Street Declaration in 1992. For the Republican movement, that was literally music to their ears. However, for the tradition which shaped me, the British Protestant Unionist Loyalist tradition, people were concerned, are the Brits going to disengage? So within the context that it shaped me as a human being, there were serious alarm bells in relation to that. It wasn't what Peter Brook was saying. It was misinterpreted. What they were trying to do was send a message to militant republicanism that as a British government, we want to see the island of Ireland, we want to see Northern Ireland at peace with itself and move towards a power-sharing and meaningful peace. People often ask me, Gary, what are one of the key concepts in keeping the peace? It's literally managed every day on the ground by ordinary people like myself. So don't assume this mechanism that there's someone sitting in the Dáil in Dublin or sitting in the White House or sitting in Downing Street managing this thing. Definitely not. It's managed every single day by people on the ground like myself, who are no different than you. Because there are mechanisms, there are relationships, there are structures. When we see warning signs, we move into conversation, we move into mediation, we move into dialogue to try to remove possible blocks that could facilitate some form of civil unrest. And that is why, as I said clearly and concisely yesterday, we need the role of civil society to maintain that fragile peace. So again, just alluding to what we talked yesterday about this multidisciplinary approach. I'm going to highlight this a little bit later on, but I'm assuming a number of you may or may not be aware, John Paul Lederach, the Mennonite scholar, has this pyramid. I don't know why some of you have seen this. If you're a Mennonite in the room, I hope you have seen it. But basically the way it works is he divides society into three strands. Those who are at the bottom, this is not said in any wrong way, those who are in the middle, and those who are at the top. And he very concisely says that primarily the best keepers of the peace are people who are in that middle strand. NGOs, faith leaders, academics. Why? Because they have access to people at the bottom, who may be in community groups, but also access to people who are at the top. So if you're interested in that later on, just Google John Paul Lederach Pyramid of Peace. It's a very, very effective, because he teases it out in much more detail than I can do in this lecture. But as I said yesterday, my colleague and friend John Brewer has developed this theory, the political peace process versus the social peace process. And as we alluded to yesterday, politicians assume that once the helicopter takes off on the lawn of the White House, or a deal is done in Paris, or in Ramallah, or in Jerusalem, that societal healing automatically follows. Societal healing comes about through people like you and me who are willing to take strategic risks to ensure that hard-won peace is bedded down. So that's why we need so many people at the table. We need politicians, but we need NGOs. We need theologians. We need ethicists. We need women's movements. We need lawyers. We need as many strands of thinking at the table. So in our context, a number of people in the late 80s and 90s had dialogue with those who were involved in violence. Now, you want to ask the question, did the British government or the Irish government ever talk to these people? The answer again is yes, they did. So in the early 1970s, the IRA were flown in a Royal Air Force plane to meet strategic figures in the British government. The IRA's approach was completely naive. They basically gave the Brits an ultimatum: disengage from Northern Ireland, or that is it. So the Republicans really refused to consider a peace settlement that didn't constitute an immediate withdrawal from the north of Ireland. A retreat of the British Army back to their barracks, a release of Republican prisoners. The British obviously refused, and the talks broke up. Now, Irish America, let me deal with that for a moment. Irish America, I've said this publicly in front of a group of Irish Americans in September last year, there was an incredibly naive approach by Irish Americans. This very simplistic approach, the Brits just need to disengage from Ireland and all will be okay. So let me give you a conversation around this with an American senator that I had a number of years ago who will be nameless. In Boston, he said to me, "You know, Gary, simply, the Brits just need to get out of Ireland." So I said to him, "Where do you want me to go?" I said, "My forefathers and foremothers have been there for 400-500 years. Where are you suggesting I go?" And I said back to him, tongue in cheek, and that, you know, maybe cheeky sense of humour I have, "That's a bit like me saying to you, why the hell don't you just go home? Because the Irish diaspora only arrived in the United States in the 19th century. So that very simplistic Irish-American approach to the conflict was unhelpful. What was also unhelpful, and gradually Irish America came to realise this, was bars in Boston and New York giving dollars to support the Republican cause that were blowing up people in the street like me. You know, and that was happening. So there can be an awful naivety in relation to conflicts. And that's just, I'm not just saying that, I'm not saying this is an American phenomenon. I'm saying this is a global phenomenon. So I have no right to come into your situation and give you a points 1 to 10, how you deal with racism and slavery. All I want to do is to be a catalyst, to give you a little bit of a push to do some thinking. So gradually there was an evolution in thought. So let me tell you a story. Last September, the former Taoiseach, Prime Minister of Ireland, Bertie O'Hearn, who was the signatory of the Good Friday Agreement, along with Tony Blair, the two of us with two other colleagues, travelled for 5 days in Boston together, did the sort of usual Boston University, Tufts, Harvard. But on the, let me get this right, Tuesday night, we did a lecture in the Edward Kennedy Institute. If you don't know of this fascinating building, Ted Kennedy's widow Vicky has created literally the US Senate inside this building, 250 seats. But what they do, they bring kids there to this place. Google it later on, EKI Center for the US Senate. So they bring kids there to wrestle with legislation, how this worked out in the Senate. So myself and Bertie O'Hearn shared the lecture that night. And it was quite interesting at the end of the night, a sizable amount of Irish Americans come up and said, it is really good for me to hear a moderate, rational, reasonable unionist position about the conflict. Because they were just fed this constant diatribe. And they all realised now the only way the Irish situation was going to be resolved was through dialogue and sharing the piece of land that we were born in together. So there's had to be a growth, there's had to be a maturity. One of the strange things that night, he was telling Joyce on the phone after it, this man, I guess, in his 70s or his 80s, come up to me with this, what was literally a piece of hardboard with this tiny little medal on it. And he said to me, Gary, this is my dad's IRA medal. From either 1916 or the War of Independence. And he said to me quite nervously, would you mind holding it? Almost as if I was holding something that was satanic because it came from another world in which I grew up in. And you know, just building relationships, I took it off him and I said to him, tell me your dad's story. Mm-hmm. Something as simple as that. Mm-hmm. And it was so, so disarming. So when you're dealing with people who are in your extremes, just a simple phrase like, tell me your story. What has shaped your worldview? I mean, I have suggested to some American audiences with sharp intakes of breath, I do think the church should be talking to the KKK. I mean, I've talked to terrorists. Can churches not engage and try to redirect these people? How did people change in the New Testament? How did they change through conversation and dialogue with Jesus? And I've often said this, and again, this is, I promise you, is an original quotation. If you lock 40 men in a room, and primarily this is men, so if you lock 40 men in a room listening to their own reassuring voices, it's a recipe for disaster. If you lock 40 men in a room listening to their own reassuring voices, it's a recipe for disaster. So how do white supremacists change? Can they change, or do we write them off? I think veering towards that, if you veer towards that, you know what, let's all pack, get in the Lady of the Lake and all go home. Because it negates the gospel. I mean, the gospel talks about change. I mean, I've seen people who are responsible for multiple murders change. How did that come about? Through engagement with theology, reasonableness, and building relationships. So civic society, and I say this with passion, needs to be able to speak in to those protracted, difficult situations. I mean, I was doing a podcast thing there, and Joyce and I were hovering in the library, and I'm not sure what the magazine was, but it talks about a person, I didn't open the cover, about a, I tell you, it was Jim Wallace's magazine, actually, Sojourners, there, where the headline says, I was a white supremacist and I changed. So the gospel has to open up that whole concept of allowing people to change. So before the signing of the Good Friday Agreement, and well after that, a number of people, including myself, were simply sounding boards for the British, Irish, and American administrations, taking what I call sort of temperature readings of where the Republican and the Loyalist movements were, trying to build trust and asking the question, if one side moves, will the other side respond? The Good Friday Agreement, you know, George Mitchell, the story, George Mitchell was in Belfast there a couple of months ago, and he told a story, you know, when Bill Clinton went to him and said, George, I have a job for you. I'm guessing 3 to 6 months should do it. And 2 years later, he's still stuck in Belfast, negotiating, trying to get us over the line. So it really was 2 years of protracted, difficult negotiations. And if you read Mitchell's account of that, at times incredibly frustrating. But the seeds for that agreement were laid after the hunger strikes. Because it was probably by 1985, the Republican movement realized that the long-term strategy needed to be political rather than militarily. And that sort of coffee encounter today in the Ark, so forgive me for those who were there, and I'm telling this story again. The people who realized in the early 90s that there was no military solution to this were not the governments. They were the British Army, the IRA, and the Loyalist groupings. They were the people that realized that. Politicians didn't at this stage. Many assume still there is a military solution to this. In the Middle East at the moment, I work with an organization, and when I say the title, you'll go, you work with an organization with that name? It's an Israeli organization based in Tel Aviv, and its name is INSS. It's the Institute for National Security Studies. So very title. It tells you all its staff, primarily, are made up of ex- IDF, Mossad, and Shabak, the Israeli Internal Intelligence Service. Those people primarily are all advocates of a two-state solution. Why? Because military people realize sometimes the barbarism of war. I mean, that organization is headed up by Amos Yadlin, the former head of IDF intelligence. And yet they've all moved towards a position. If you get a chance at some stage, watch a documentary called The Gatekeepers. Some of you may have seen it. It's an interview with the last five heads of internal Israeli intelligence. All of them are saying, we need to move towards a two-state solution. So sometimes, and you need to hear this, it's not the military the problem. It's the controllers of the military who are the problem, i.e. the politicians, who sometimes are the most difficult to persuade, those who have fought the war, those who are sleeping in different beds every night. You know what? I'll give you an example. A relative of mine who was in the police, every single day, when they come out to get into their car, they had to check onto their car. So the mechanism is this. This is a family member, so they come out to take their 3 kids to school, so they get down, lie on their tummy, look underneath the car, no bomb, fire your kids in the back seat, like this is 365 days a year, start your car, drop your kids to school. That happens every day during our conflict because the IRA developed these very sophisticated undercar booby traps. You know, Joyce knows the story where in the early days that the little daughter was saying, Daddy, what are you doing? Looking for the cat. And then eventually she realized, you're not looking for the cat. So people that live under that concept all the time. A family member of mine who was married to a relative of mine, the police service in Northern Ireland wore quite distinctive green shirts. These were the days before tumble dryers. If you remember when you kind of hung your washing out on the line outside to dry, that couldn't happen because you weren't sure about your neighbors. Would my neighbor see my husband's shirt, realize he was a member of the police, and before you know it, they're shot dead, or there's a booby trap under your car? So in a very small community like ours, you can realize the trauma, the psychological pain, who do I trust, who do I not trust, and how that pervades every aspect of society. So eventually we reached ceasefires in 1994. The IRA ceasefire was broken on my birthday, so I remember this pretty well, being in a restaurant, February the 9th, 1996, when the IRA broke their ceasefire. Let me tell you the story behind that. Prior to the breaking of that ceasefire, I was organising a meeting for around about 80 to 100 sort of Methodist lay people to engage with about 10 to 12 very senior Republicans or people who were involved in the IRA. So 2 weeks, 3 weeks before the meeting, which I'm guessing was early March 96, the IRA ripped the heart out of London, Canary Wharf, causing billions of pounds worth of damage and killed two people. I come under immense pressure, and I mean immense pressure, by people in the church, need to cancel this meeting, can't be talking to these people when they're bombing the heart out of London, don't be doing it. I refused to cancel the meeting. I went ahead with the meeting, and I said this in relation to the meeting, and let me just give you this phrase. I said, at the meeting, as loud and as raucous and as difficult and as volatile in the conversation was in the room that night, it was not as loud and as damaging as bombs going off in Canary Wharf. And it allowed these 12 Republicans to hear 100 voices from civic society, angry voices. Okay, the Republicans had their reasons. The British are not moving to demilitarize quick enough. Like, so you bomb the heart out of London and kill two innocent people? This is your logic. This is what you do as a movement. You as a movement are saying to us, you want to build peace. But because the time scale doesn't work quick enough for you, you just decide to shred the economic heart of London and kill two innocent people. So I want to suggest that even during the most difficult times and conflicts, there needs to be channels that allow key people to have meaningful conversations to attempt to end the cycle of violence. And that's why I'm saying the next point is crucial. Religion and religious leadership needs to be involved. I remember that evening a person who is a Methodist colleague whose father was a police person who was murdered by the IRA. I remember him quite emotionally telling that story and getting up and reading a psalm to these 12 IRA strategists or Republican strategists. You know, a very human cry within a psalm. So even in the midst of that, it was trying to build relationships in the midst of violence. So religious leadership needs to play a role. You look at the Middle East, you look at the United States, there was a clergy person, Martin Luther King, South Africa, Desmond Tutu, Alan Story was here a couple of weeks ago. I mean, Alan's dad, Peter Story, was very involved in peace building in the South African context. Within the Northern Ireland context, clergy played a key role. I'm not saying they were not the panacea for the conflict, but they played a very strategic role in dialogue. So some of my work now is talking to imams in Israel, ultra-Orthodox rabbis, and asking the question, what is the role of religious leadership using this multidisciplinary approach? And if you remember the quotation from Jonathan Sacks the other day about religion having power, and whatever is power can be used, misused, and abused. So as religious leaders, one of our key components needs to be and ensure that religious power is not being abused. Let me spill on a little here. Important signals. So Bill Clinton played the most key role of any United States president in the Northern Ireland peace process. There was a large American constituency, as you know, and Bill Clinton took a very difficult but strategic risk in giving the Sinn Féin Republican leader, Gerry Adams, a visa to enter the United States in early 1994. Now, the ceasefires hadn't even been called yet, okay? It was August 1994 before the IRA declared their ceasefire. I mean, Clinton would tell you it was not an overnight decision. His Secretary of State said he was wrong. The State Department said he was wrong. a number of people, and he's since said this quite openly, this could be political suicide. But he was persuaded, with many people saying this could be the possibility of a game changer. Remember the phrase I said earlier? It was a very big confidence-building measure. Because there was a mechanism within more militant republicanism, if we go down the political route, are there political rewards? So the following year in November 1995, and Chuck and Peg know this location, Bill Clinton developed a major address in Northern Ireland, in West Belfast, literally just at the back of the church at that stage that I was pastoring, at the back of Forspring, that big ugly sort of metal building that kind of sits there. And after he had done that, he got out and, what do you call, Americans call that big, that chunky car that presidents drive in, the Beast or something, isn't it? So he gets in this car, travels down the Springfield Road, turns left onto the Falls Road, and by coincidence, Gerry Adams is just stumbling out of a shop with his little bag of morning scones, having bought them at 11 a.m. Clinton's cavalcade stops. Clinton steps out, walks over, and publicly shakes Gerry Adams' hand. It was not a coincidence, as you know. The thing was totally choreographed, but this was the American administration's way of saying, if militant republicanism continues down the route of political engagement, we will work with you to get a result. So that was a very strategic risk by your president to do that. 2 weeks later, he took a little boy from my church, David Stirrett, and a little Catholic girl from the other side. And if you Google it, there's photos of these kids kind of sitting in the Oval Office beside Clinton with their parents. And he used the kids as illustrations, saying, you need to look to the future. He subsequently has visited the island on a number of occasions, along with Hillary Clinton, and they have been very committed to that peace process. But what did it say? It said this. Clinton was saying, as the leader of the free world, we are willing to bring republicanism into a political process. It also said to the hawks, because you're always managing your movements. You have your hawks and your doves in every movement. So it was saying to the hawks, who needed to be convinced, that political dialogue will achieve much more than armed struggle. And as I said, that handshake was not organized overnight. But it was another key moment in the evolution of republicanism from a military movement to a political dialogue. I told you even after that, the IRA still broke its ceasefire, but it's acknowledged now by most commentators it was a key moment in moving republicanism forward. What about loyalism or unionism? The key words for unionism or loyalism was this: the union is safe. In other words, the union with the UK was safe. And those were the keys to the Good Friday Agreement, the principle of consent. Let me talk for a moment about the Good Friday Agreement. There are normally three types of peace process, okay? The first one is very military. Sri Lanka is a typical example. The government forces crush the Tamil Tigers, and you work in the assumption they will never rise again. That is always an assumption, because they may, okay? Second one is the South African, where we see regime change, colonial change at the top, but not a lot of difference at the bottom. And so let's be honest about that. I know we hold up the South African peace process as a brilliant model. I mean, South Africa economically is still not in great shape economically. So we got rid of the sort of colonial regime change, apartheid, but the benefits economically of apartheid being dismantled has still not spilled onto the ground. South Africa is still quite a violent place. I mean, 4 months ago, I was with a young woman from a township in Joburg who's saying the violence against the LGBT community in some townships is at an all-time high. So there still is a lot of work. So their process is still ongoing. And the third one is really ours, that we call a second preference peace process. And verbally, they're still the most difficult because no one gets their own way. So it's all about compromise. I mean, Jonathan Powell, who was Tony Blair's chief negotiator at the Good Friday Agreement, has written a book entitled Great Hatred, Little Room, which is simply subtext for the hatred was so great between Catholics and Protestants, there was little room for negotiation. But there was a masterpiece in the Good Friday Agreement. So let me tell you some of those. There were north-south ministerial bodies established. That satisfied those within the nationalist Republican side. There were east-west bodies established, satisfying the unionist side. The principle of consent was the key, meaning there will never be a united Ireland until the people, both north and south, vote for a united Ireland. The Irish government, this was really difficult, and Bertie O'Hearn, who is the former Irish Prime Minister, said to me in his own sort of caustic way, he said, it was bloody hell, he says, trying to get them to agree to remove Articles 2 and 3. Articles 2 and 3 of the Irish Constitution claimed constitutional jurisdiction over Northern Ireland. So that had always been there. So that was a struggle, because many people in the Republic saw Northern Ireland, even though it's in a kind of nostalgic framework, it really should be part of an all-Ireland Republic. So that was a major piece they gave up. So it was built on relationships. It was built on compromise. It was built on consent. But those three words I've just said, I couldn't exist in my marriage without consent, without compromise, without a relationship. So there are very human words built into what was a political document. There have been subsequent agreements. There's been the St Andrews Agreement, the Leeds Castle Agreement, the Hillsborough Castle Agreement. We've had the Fresh Start Agreement, and there will probably be more. So the Good Friday Agreement, as I've said, I don't want to do this without looking at my notes even, was really a win-win situation for all people involved. So in that sense, and this is key, both Republicans, Nationalists, Unionists, Loyalists were able to walk outside that door after the negotiations with enough to sell to their own community. So remember the word I used yesterday? No one felt humiliated. There was enough to get us over the line. And again, that's another key component. So between Republicans and Democrats and between, you know, Tories and Labour, if we continue to humiliate the other person, you're not going to get a deal. And on the occasions when I watch CNN and watch Fox News, you know what? Like, that's just a blinking propaganda feast all round. And all it's doing, honestly, as an outside observer, it's just making this country more divided, more acrimonious, more volatile, more problematic. So, you know, the media, and we have these difficulties as well. I have a number of good friends who are journalists. Journalism needs to be more responsible in dealing with volatile situations. We have these conversations as well with that kind of sensationalist media which can literally stoke the fires as well. So, time-wise, let me see where I am. Over time as usual, okay. The importance of words. So, you know, words are crucial. We talked a little bit about that yesterday when I said, you know, Abraham Joshua's quotation, it was words, not machines, that produced Auschwitz. One of the biggest sticking points in the Good Friday Agreement was what we called the D word, decommissioning of weapons. So the IRA saw that phrase as a phrase of surrender, and so did those on the Loyalist side. So you got to be creative. So the IRA did decommission their weapons, but never used the D word. They used the word, we are putting our weapons beyond use. The Loyalists used the phrase, we are putting our weapons beyond reach. The Rosomon Society wanted photographs of all this stuff, but people were saying, you know what, this is just humiliation. So what happened was there were independent witnesses who verified that the arms were put beyond reach and put beyond use, And as I think I told you, the first day of the lecture, the Ulster Volunteer Force and Red Hand Commando did their decommissioning statement, which is probably still the language I use, in my church building. Which was a very moving day, as I've written about this. There were no tears shed, but in my throat I did have this huge lump, knowing that the people in that room had been responsible for many, many loss of lives and difficulties. So I remember just kind of finishing that article off and writing about it, and I told the story in May 2012. Joyce and I took the leadership of the UVF and the Red Hand Commando to Israel and Palestine for conversations. And I remember on a Saturday evening, I think it was, Joyce, we were walking through Arab East Jerusalem, and sort of Joyce and I and some Israelis and Palestinians were sort of lagging behind this group of men, 12 men. And I turned to the Israelis, Palestinians, and said, you know, between them, you know, that group of people has been responsible for almost 500 deaths plus in our conflict. And I said, and here we are tonight, walking through Arab East Jerusalem on the way to a drinks reception at the British Consul. That is progress. And I remember the Israelis and Palestinians turning and saying, you know, Gary, someday I just simply hope we can say the same. Okay, quick. This is really quick because it's normal. It's just me. I've gone over time. We covered some of this yesterday, so I'm not going to go into detail. And I'll maybe just skip it and we'll get a conversation. Let me just read you a little blog that I wrote, and then I'll tie up with a couple of things. 2 years ago, the Skenos building, as I've told you, was a shared space. That was why it was developed, to allow difficult conversations post-conflict. So we've had a number of those, but an organisation in Belfast, which I haven't worked closely with, had invited Patrick McGee and Joe Berry, names probably most of you don't know. So let me give you their bios. Patrick McGee was the Brighton bomber who almost killed Margaret Thatcher and her whole cabinet in the hotel in Brighton during the Conservative Tory Party conference in 1987, if my memory serves me right. I think it was them. And in that bombing, Jo Berry lost her dad. And they since have moved into a relationship to try to understand each other's worlds. This was on Thursday evening. So on the Wednesday, I arrived down at Skenos. And, you know, our nice new square, because the place wasn't that long open, had a lot of graffiti, no IRA bastards in this building, and no tags here. So TIG is like your N-word, okay? So it is. So this was all around this square. So BBC straight out, you know, that don't take those journalists long to find out what's happening. Gary, is this event going to go ahead? Are you going to allow a bomber into this building in this loyalist community? And I said yes. I said we still need to have these difficult conversations. Senior loyalists who had been involved in fighting against these IRA guys said, yes, we need the conversation. Now, here's the problem of peace processes. The younger generation of loyalists. So in other words, some of those who hadn't fought the war thought this was a bad idea. So I arrived down for the evening, 100 protesters across my church, ring of police across the square in Skenos, mini sort of riot, civil unrest breaks out. And Patrick McGee comes in through the back door, has to go out through the back door. And if you excuse my French for a moment, I was telling a colleague about this afterwards. I says, oh, they were cursing and shouting and throwing bricks and throwing rocks and throwing bottles and singing. And one of my Methodist colleagues, a minister, says to me, what were they singing? And I said, they were singing that new Methodist hymn. And he says, what is that? And I says, Gary Mason is a bastard. So this, you know. So you do have to smile and all this here. But after it, I wrote a blog on the Queen's University website. So let me read that to you and then we'll have a conversation. So the blog was entitled, I Know Bombers. Okay, so it goes like this. On the 23rd of October, 1993, I stood outside the Mater Hospital in the Crumlin Road in Belfast. With my arms around Alan McBride, whose wife Sharon had just been murdered by an IRA bomber in the Shankill bombing. His words still echo in my mind, "She's gone, she's gone." I'd gotten to know Alan and Sharon while doing theology at Queen's University, and one of my ministerial placements was at their home church as I trained to be an ordained minister. I'd read the scripture reading at their wedding a few years earlier to that fateful October day. That evening of October 23rd, I was at the bedside of Wilma McKee a few hours before she died, another victim of the Shankill IRA bomber. Wilma, just 38 years of age, had been relieved by the news she was clear of cancer just 24 hours before her untimely death. As I left her side in that hospital room, I met her family clinging to any sort of hope I could offer them in a catastrophic situation. I can still close my eyes and see the raw pain on their faces in that hospital corridor. I got home that evening having been out all day comforting those caught up in that nightmare. I cried myself to sleep. I know better than most about bombers. I know the awful devastation that IRA bombers, and indeed any bomber, can visit on the lives of the innocent. I conducted the service of the most famous UVF bomber turned peacemaker and loyalist politician David Irvine in January 2007. We became good friends. Almost by accident, I got caught up in the furore that has surrounded the visit of the Brighton bomber Patrick McGee to the East Belfast Mission Skenos site on Thursday evening, the 30th of January, 2014. The event was not organised by East Belfast Mission Skenos or I, but by another Christian group, but it fell within the ethos of what we did as an organisation. I felt, however, that the event, painful as it was, should go ahead. Peacemaking is incredibly risky. Those who protested outside East Belfast Mission may or may not have sat at the bedsides of those dying from bomb injuries, or sat at the bedside of the late David Irvine as he breathed his last breath, the bomber turned peacemaker. I know better than most about bombers. In a sentence, if you ask me why Patrick McGee was allowed on the premises of East Belfast Mission in the loyalist heartland of East Belfast, it's simple. I do not want any more Patrick McGee's. I know bombers. I know firsthand the pain they can inflict. And as a follower of Jesus Christ, if a controversial dialogue stops anyone else ever planting a bomb on this island, I am going to dialogue and take risks for peace. So to those protesters outside the mission, this may seem strange, but most of you were quite young. You have, I hope, an amazing future ahead of you, free, I hope, from bombers. I do not want to be visiting you as a clergy person in a bloody bed or conducting your funeral in a few years' time, the victim of a dissident bomber. The site you stood on to protest was where the British Secretary of State, Dr. John Reid, met the Loyalist Commission in July 2002 to pave a way forward for Loyalists to embrace the peace process. It was the site where the late David Irvine was buried from in January 2007. It was also the site from where the UVF and Red Hand Commando did their decommissioning statement in June 2009. It was the site where Her Majesty the Queen and the Duke of Edinburgh came in March 2008 to commend the work of the Loyalist East Belfast community. I also hope that it may be the site that took a risk in listening to an IRA bomber who maybe, just maybe, will speak into the lives of young Republicans who may want to be dissident bombers and ask them to think about another way. You never know. To those outside protesting last night, maybe this event just saved your life from a future dissident bomber. I hope so. Because as a Christian minister who has spent 27 years working in the inner city of Belfast, never more than 200 metres from an interface, through some of the most savage acts of this conflict, I want your young lives to be free from bombers. Because the words of dialogue, however difficult, are never as loud or as damaging as the bombs that have bloodied this place for decades. And I just left that on a blog, and rather than me go on media, I let that blog defend itself. And so in that context, I mean, just a couple of things there, just a sort of photographs here. I'm not going to go through all this stuff because we did it yesterday. So this was the visit of the Queen to East Belfast Mission. People have often teased me about that and says, Gary, you should do one of those caption things, you know, where, you know, from her mouth, what is she thinking? You know, probably, I wish he would get this sermon over. So that was a very strategic visit, and again organised by the British government as we moved into the whole peace process, for the palace saying, this is the way forward. So since that, the Queen has visited Dublin, led a wreath at the site of where the Easter Rising, where people there were trying to overthrow the British in Dublin. Mary McAleese, who was the President of Ireland on two occasions, who is a good friend of mine, has also gone to London. So people in positions like that, again, can bring about a good solution and create a context. So leadership in this country has to be warm, inclusive, embracing, and keep everyone at the table. Again, this was way back when I was honoured by the Queen for my work in peace building. I'm not that tall, but the Queen's really only this height. She was standing on a podium, she was much higher. Just in case you think she likes you growing to 6 feet, but she hadn't, you know. And then again, I was mentioning about Bill Clinton earlier on. 2 years ago, Bill came to Northern Ireland and the American government picked 5 people to meet him, and I was the religious person that was asked then to meet him. So it was a great honour, you know, just having that, you know, to give him a briefing from a religious framework of where I sort of thought things were. So, right, questions, comments? Okay, yeah, Dawn, go ahead.
At the appropriate time, could you resume what you see happening between the current head of the British government and the 10 people in her government, I think they're in her government now, and how, what that means for the peace process?
Okay, that's the Democratic Unionist Party who have signed. Okay. Yeah, so, as I said, just repeat the question. Dawn's asking, we have just had, you know, we're like electioned out in a sense. You know, some of us are going to end up crunching Prozac if we have any more elections in Northern Ireland over the next while. But we just had a local election in March, which was another disaster. Then we had the elections there in June. So, you know, talk about pundits getting it wrong. When Theresa May called that election, they were saying she was going to end up with a majority of 70 or 80 members of parliament. And, you know, she really, like, just didn't engage with people at all. It was very cold. What was that?
Cream. She got cream.
Yes, okay. So she ended up, to get her majority in parliament, she assigned a deal with a Northern Ireland Unionist Party, that would be our most right of centre party, the Democratic Unionist Party. She has signed a deal with them. They were the last party really to come into the peace process. In a strange way, Dawn, they are an evolving party. If you'd asked me that question 20 years ago, the dominating thesis there was really religious fundamentalism within a Protestant framework. So in your context, thinking the sort of like a Jerry Falwell, Bob Jones, that would have been the sort of dominating narrative there. The party is becoming slightly more secular, but still right of centre. The difficulty over that is that the DUP and the Conservatives have been very pro-Brexit, which is the disengagement of the UK from the European Union. The twist in that is, just to kind of make this a little bit more complex, so Scotland and Northern Ireland voted to remain. But it was really irrelevant because at the end of the day, constitutionally, it was a UK-wide vote. So both England and Wales voted to exit the European Union. Scotland, Northern Ireland didn't. However, Northern Ireland, never simple, because the Good Friday Agreement is an international agreement. So it's not just constitutionally a local agreement. The Irish government have been part of it, the EU have been part of it, the Americans have had influence on it. So the key to it was what we call now a soft border between Northern Ireland and the Republic. The difficulty is, once Brexit takes place, and I hope it never does, and I hope something goes wrong that it doesn't take place, but if we're on the trajectory that it's going to take place, we could end up done with a hard border between Northern and Southern Ireland, which is going to antagonise a lot of people within the Republican nationalist community. So it's trying to be managed at the moment within Europe that there will be a soft border in relation to that, and the hope is the DUP and the Conservatives will assent to that border. But politically and theologically, they are right of centre. There's no question about that. But in saying that, their overall leader, Ian Paisley, who you may or may not have heard of, but politically and theologically would have been right of centre, but he did eventually do a deal with Sinn Féin in 2007 and went into a power-sharing government. He's probably, to be honest, the only person that could have done it, and to bring in many of those you're talking about, this lecture bringing in extremes, he was able to bring in a fair amount of his extremes. Now, he didn't bring them all, because a number of the sort of religious right-wing fundamentalists did shred away from the party. So you had Ian Paisley, who was all through the conflict, he was known as Dr. No. He said no to everything. He finally becomes Dr. Yes. And Martin McGuinness, who was the chief of staff of the IRA, who just died, and Martin McGuinness died, we were in the States this year, March time. You had those two people. There was probably nobody else, Dawn, could have done that. Because Martin McGuinness was the iconic figure of militant republicanism. You know, the young boy standing in the bog side during the civil rights movement, leading the IRA. So in that sense, for to get as many people over the line as possible, those two extremes had to be in there. But it still is a precarious arrangement. You know, having a majority of 10, you know, is not great. So it isn't. Other questions, comments? This lady here.
Hey, Gary. So what about in the current political climate in the United States? You've worked with, you know, multi-denominational, bringing people together.
Yeah.
When we're so divided that we had the majority of Christian congregations followed the Trump thing, and then we've got the people out here. It seems like we're so far divided. I'm not even sure how. I mean, you said it's important not to have humiliation.
Yeah.
But how? I mean, where do you even start?
I was here for 2 months, and I think I mentioned this, mid-February through to mid-April. And there were a couple of pastors who will be nameless who just said to me, Gary, don't even mention this. Don't even allude to it. My church is on the verge of a split. Don't even mention it. You know, and I say this, I mean, pastoral life, for those of us in this room who are pastors, it's difficult enough keeping your congregation on board over, let's have a worship band, you know, or let's change the colour of the carpet, you know, just like as hell, but trying to manage all that at the same time. But I still say there has to come a time within a theological or Christian framework that these conversations need to be had. So I'm being honest, I think if I was a pastor now pastoring a church, in which there are bound to be both Republicans and Democrats, there has to be some conversation within, and I would still want to say, within that eternal framework of how we begin some conversation and dialogue together. Because either that, or this, it's going to continue to be acrimonious continually. I think it's for yourselves to wrestle and struggle with some of that. I guess in the way I was talking about that black and white encounter under Journey and Understanding, you're nearly going to need some conversation around Democrats and Republicans in relation to how, you know, I mean, in that portico I was telling you about that I spoke at in, what was it, in Tampa there, and sort of, yeah, mid-February, a young woman, I guess early 40s, stood up and, like, she says, my best friend and I, you know, from high school, we've just had to stop seeing each other. We cannot. Now, I have to say this, and like, I'm not sort of like McCarthyism reds onto the beds, and you know, there's a demon in every person theology. That's not my theology. But there's almost something bizarrely demonic about this in a strange way.
Yeah.
You know, it's like principalities and powers. That how has this happened? Now, the other theory, I guess, in that, was this always below the surface? And what has happened now gives people permission to talk about this and shred one another. But I think the church does need to be doing some serious analysis around that. Like Joyce and I stay with folk in Orlando who both are Trump voters, who were at our daughter's wedding 6 or 7 weeks ago, and they are the salt of the earth. I don't know why I'm in trouble.
But they see Jesus very differently than we do.
These folk are liberals.
They're what?
They would be liberal. Lifestyle-wise. They just couldn't bring themselves to vote Clinton. They firmly, and maybe it's easier for me to say that because I'm assuming, I mean, there could be some Trump voters in this room. I probably know by the kind of ethos here, most of you are probably Democrats. But they struggle badly. They actually believe Clinton had been deceitful over Benghazi. So there wasn't the kind of, I want to go for a right-wing white. They actually, there was a bit of a moral struggle there around that. You know, so while, you know, and I would just say this to you, while you mightn't agree, all I would say to you, you know, having dealt with conflict, like for most of my life, just try to hear and understand, you know, and I think even questions that people like that, tell me why, help me understand it, what are your fears, is there anything that would help dispel those fears? I mean, Travis, were you my dish friend? Did you come to this? Yeah. I mean, we were chatting this morning and you were telling me the story about, you know, the people who were doing the mine remediation. Most of them were Trump voters and you were all in a room together when the election results are coming through. So the thing, you had built relationships with those people. And again, I would say this. Is it worthwhile destroying and shredding those relationships over this? Or is there another way to handle that painful tension together? I don't know what the answer to that is, but I think, you know, if the church, you know, if the more mainline denominations are going to become CNN, okay, and the Southern Baptists and the fundamentalists are going to become Fox News, like, seriously, God help this nation. You know, if that's the totality of your narrative over the next while, you're going to have to find some other way to do this. And like, I'm wrestling with it. You folk have much more knowledge of this than I have because you're breathing this and eating this every day. But all I'm saying, there must be some way to do some bridge building. Whatever that looks like, let me hear your narrative. Let me understand. What were your fears? What are your concerns? What would allay your fears? Do you need to enter in the dialogue with people to understand those fears? You know, and if I'm wrong, and I may well be, tell me what's the alternative. If any of you have a better plan, tell me what it is to bridge this. But just get this gentleman here, and then this lady, then this lady. John, is you a comment or a question?
Well, I kind of rethought.
Okay. This lady here. Okay.
I guess I feel that we need to remove the partisan narrative, and that's where we find our commonality, because I think that there is commonality among all people, regardless of which party they belong to, and that's where the narrative, and we've got to stop this Trump voter versus Clinton voter, because that doesn't define us, and I've heard too many people say that defines people. It doesn't define people. What defines people is our commonality and our desire for our future of our country and for our children and our grandchildren and our great-grandchildren. And I think that's where we need to start.
Yeah. I think I just saw that, as I said yesterday, not to be like uber hyper-spiritual about all this. You know, I hope I live another 30 years, and if I do, when I'm dying in a hospital in Belfast or wherever, I can tell you this, Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton will not be in my mind. You know, I promise you that. When I'm wired up with morphine or whatever, I will not be thinking about those two people. Trust me, I won't. But I will be thinking about my relationship with Jesus Christ and the thing that shaped me as a human being. And as I said yesterday, that quotation which I came out with, probably after two glasses of red wine in a friend's house in Orlando, sitting by their lake, don't let the temporal dictate the eternal. Don't, and you know, be so careful about that. We are still, And I don't want us to be so heavenly minded that we're no so earthly good, but I have a little tiny quotation on my desk there that still was A.W. Tozer, the evangelical mystic who pastored the People's Church. And it says this: Lord, keep me eternity conscious. That there's a bigger framework to all this as well. I saw a hand over there. Yes, this way.
I think I hear a lot of conversation among people who are appalled by Trump.
Yeah.
Why did people vote for him? What's wrong with those people?
Yeah.
And I think we need, those of us who are appalled, need to put that question aside.
Yeah.
Because what we're looking for is an answer of what is wrong with them, and if we can figure out what's wrong with them,
sort
then
them
we
out.
Can fix it.
That puts
a barrier between us and them, and it will not fix it, it will exacerbate. And so this approach to what is your story opens up the door.
Yeah. And I think in my context, that's storytelling. You know, I mean, I have taken, as Joyce knows, senior UVF and UDA people of all political violence away with IRA terrorists. And they've talked, they've told their story. And you know, they're not that dissimilar. We're killing each other. Remember one time I took away this pretty kind of exclusive hotel about 30 miles away from Belfast, and these people consume, you know, in the course of an evening, much too much alcohol. So, you know, by the time we'd kind of had dinner, added a couple of glasses of wine, it was 10 o'clock, I said, I need to go to bed. But I'm going to bed leaving 20 people who 10 years ago were blowing each other to bits, shooting each other, burning each other's houses in a bar with too much alcohol. So I goes to bed and goes, God, will this work out okay? It was fine. They ended up together, drunk, teaching each other their songs. They were fine. So they were. It was a risk. A funny story out of this is quite funny. When we set up the David Irvine Foundation in memory of David, a good friend of mine who was very heavily involved in political violence, and I'd brought him and another leading Republican together. So two stories in this. And I remember the first time I took Jim to meet Joe. And when Jim stepped into Joe's house for the first time, there's always a few expletives around this, which are too extreme for a gathering like this, where he said, the last time one of you effers was in this house, they were trying to kill me, you know. So it was. But the evening we had the David Irvine Foundation, again, there was much too much alcohol consumed, and Joe was sitting with his arm around Jim's wife, and the typical sort of, you know, Belfast, cheeky sense of humour, Jim goes over and says, we may be all friends now, but you're not getting my effing wife. I took his arm off. You know. So there's something disarming about human engagement in that sense. So one final question or comment, and then I guess we need to eat. Yeah, Travis, go ahead. So we'll do two, these two young men up here. I'm looking this way, not looking upwards.
So it might be a session onto itself.
Okay.
From your own experiences that you've shared, how do you think Holden could or should best engage these sorts of conversations and issues?
Yeah, yeah. I was saying yesterday, Travis, I mean, I think numerous people have said to me that out of the sessions, out of the what I call the internal, the external outside this village has been shaped. But I suppose you've had that 2 year plus recess with the fire. I mean, the whole phrase about beginning together, new beginnings, is very embryonic in itself. So I was just kind of saying yesterday, you know, if the biggest issue is slavery, racism, probably other issues, but is there a mechanism that Holden begins to create a, you know, an arm that begins to say, look, as well as all the different topics, environmentalism, all the other, the role of art, the role of literature, etc., the role of liturgy and worship are all crucial, but you take a 5-year designated time span and say, we want to give a lot of energy to this. So this is our 5-year project that we begin to explore, and what does that look like? Does that involve people coming here for conversation? What is the outcome of this? Because I think, yeah, I was saying to somebody, I mean, at the moment I'm in no committees, thankfully, and when I do go on a committee, the question I now ask is, I don't want this. I see church statements, you know, they have some relevance, but in reality, they die after 2 or 3 deaths. So what would be the outcomes for Holden if you're embarking on a project like that? You know, I said this somebody today, you know, we're talking. I mean, I'm just surmising this. I'm assuming in the United States this is complete conjecture, but I would imagine over the next, you know, 5 years, churches will, not imagine, this is a fact, will spend billions of dollars on new buildings, internal refurbishment, and whatever else. Is there a strand that come out of that where churches would say, right, we're creating 10 scholarships for some kids in the inner city. This is going to be our contribution on a practical side, as well as dealing with what you would call structural racism. So just how you begin those conversations is really up to you. But again, if the church doesn't lead this, I guess I've got to ask the question, who else in America is going to do it? Can you tell me a politician you know is devoted to doing this, or a group of politicians? So I just think you need a stream or a strand. What does that look like? And I don't think it's just about bringing, you know, black leaders here to dialogue with white leaders. I'm just not saying you've got that's enough. You know, is there a Holden brand that goes out there as well? So do you end up with some Holden satellites? I'm not talking something in this scale, but that there is a Holden movement that spills into various cities within the United States. And I'm just brainstorming in my own skull, but that begins to address some of this. So are there Holden think tanks in different cities that are, you know, interdenominational that begins to wrestle with some of those? All I'm saying, I think, is there are questions you just need to ask yourselves. Okay, this young man here, and then we... You remind me of Ruud Gullit, who was a brilliant footballer for Holland. You're very, very like him. So every time I look at you, I go, yeah, he was a hero of mine when I was much younger. Brilliant, brilliant soccer player. So Google him later. Tell me you think you look like him.
All right, thank you. Well, there's maybe a larger topic as well. But,
okay.
So in the past couple of days, I've heard a couple parallels drawn to our current situation. And I think the biggest ones being the racial divide that we have,
okay.
Which obviously has very, historic roots, and then also the current political divide. And in the talks that we've been having about them, I haven't really gotten the sense of how I think those two are related. And like personally, I've always kind of, in my context, understood or kind of had the impression that the one, the racial one, has almost become kind of subsumed under the political, where you have on one side of the spectrum people who, like most of us in this room, I assume, are open to addressing that wound and want to take that sort of, you know, that sort of task upon ourselves. And then you have on the other side people who don't want to do that at all, or don't think it's an issue, don't want to weigh in. So I guess I don't know, how are those two parallels? Is that the same issue? Are they, I don't know, separate?
Yeah. No, it is a great question. I mean, if you're asking, I think initially the slavery one has been here, it's a long, long time. And I said to a couple of people, I think sometimes Americans almost inadvertently, I mentioned this I think on Monday for the first I spoke here, Tuesday, assume that almost this racism is a recent phenomenon, and it's not. You know, your epicenter is the same as mine. And that's why when I go to Emory University in 2 weeks' time, I twin racism and sectarianism. Because, I mean, ours primarily began 16th, 17th century in the same way that slavery did. Sadly, it began within a religious context. That's why I want to argue strongly that it should be religious leaders should be dealing with this. Because, sad to say, messy, toxic religion sadly set the framework for all this nationalistic chaos that we're struggling with globally now as well. I think, as you know, as an outside observer looking in and the whole American concept, the chances of Donald Trump ever coming to Holden and addressing you isn't going to happen, you know, for better or for worse. But there must be a way to get close to that administration, you know, for at least people to sit down and say, I want you to help me understand what makes you think, what does it look like to make America great again, and here is my definition of that. That there's some cross-fertilization around that. My hope would be that in the middle, there is some rational thinking comes out of that. Because as I look at the dialogue at the moment, it's a sort of hand grenade mentality. It's lobbing something into their camp, letting it explode, and then we may damage a couple of them. They do exactly the same. There's nothing more crucial. I mean, let me just finish with this here, and this I should have done this. So, I mean, it's 10 points that I'm going to do in 30 seconds, okay? So just let me do this quickly. If you were to ask me for 10 lessons from the Irish peace process, here they are. Inclusion. No person should be excluded. Good faith. I mean, I'll email this to anybody at once, or I'll email it to Chuck and he can put it in the library. So that implied covenant of good faith is a general presumption that parties deal with each other honestly and fairly. They're all biblical principles. Changing the status quo, being willing to challenge your own status quo, is an essential part of getting on the path to creating change. All issues are on the agenda. So when we went in the room for negotiation, everything was on the table. So don't hold back on anything that's important. If deeply held issues are not on the table, they're going to come back to haunt you. You know, and sometimes the church are the worst at keeping volatile issues off the table, and we create this false sort of unity. All root causes need to be addressed. So if something presents a difficulty, is seen as a curse of conflict, it has to be addressed. Time frames focus minds. That's why I said, you know, can this be a 5-year project, maybe a 3-year project we're holding? Time frames focus minds. So clever negotiators, you know, they can drag talks out. If they're not looking for agreement, why do they do that? They do that to ensure they collapse. Time frames help focus minds. So patience, understanding, no preconditions as you're going into this, and that's always difficult because we all have our preconditions. No predetermining, strong leadership, confidentiality. Leaks will destroy any process. You need to ensure that that's adhered to, and the eternal cohesion of your support base. You know, how do you bring your own support base with you? So there's no way, if you want to put this politically, either the Democrats or the Republicans or people in your churches, unless you're sure you have a reasonable support base, or you're going to end up with more fragmentation. I mean, I wrote an article again, Chuck, I think it's on that. It's called Intergroup Consensus. How do you work within your group to gain consensus? And simple things like, in our context, gradually competing terrorist groups learned to reframe the enemy's actions. So let me give you one example, and then we really need to go, or there'll not be any dinner tonight at all. So Shankill bombing, guy kills 9 people, Gerry Adams carries the coffin of the dead bomber. People from my community went, this guy is talking peace, and he's carrying the coffin of someone who's just shredded the lives of 9 people. But those who were more astute knew that if he didn't carry that coffin, he would lose a sizable amount of his support base who were hawks, who were sceptical about that. So learning to reframe the other person's actions and stuff like this is absolutely crucial. So asking the questions, why are a majority of people voting for Trump or voting for Clinton? What are the reasons? So it's reframing some of those actions, and understanding those actions can be really crucial in getting everyone over the line. Rather than just reacting, I will never speak to that person again because they did this. It's going below and saying, what were the reasons? Now, for some people, the reasons for doing that may be totally volatile and completely disingenuous. That puts a different scenario. But sometimes drilling down and asking, why did they do that? Adams would say to you now, if I didn't do it, I may never have gotten an IRA ceasefire. Because even in that October 93, which was hellish in our Irish context, multiple murders, they were thinking of the possibility of a ceasefire the next year. So we had to get the majority of a support base over the line. So look, I better stop there or we'll all be in enforced diets and go from there.